On Baltimore Public Media, we're on the record. I'm Sheila Cast. Good morning. There may have been some suspense in the closing hours of the 2024 General Assembly. Bills that had seemed popular but got snarled up in unresolved differences between the two chambers. But there was no uncertainty that the session was done, over, finished at midnight. With us this morning, two journalists who covered the issues from opening day in January until sine die last night. Joining us this morning from Annapolis is Matt Bush, WYPR's news director. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
Also in Annapolis, Pamela Wood, who covers government and politics for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner. Welcome back to the show, Pamela.
Good morning, Sheila. Thanks for having me.
Sure. One bill the legislature has to pass is a budget. The House and Senate struck a $63 billion deal last week. Where did things land, Pam? And what were the sticking points in reaching this compromise?
Yeah, it was all about raising more money, or not raising more money. That's what the budget was about this year. Governor Wes Moore came in and introduced a $63 billion budget, and he was facing a shortfall when he put that together. He managed to close that gap without any major tax increases. He did some reshuffling of money. He did some cuts to some specific programs. They called that rebasing. That was a new term we learned this year. But then that goes in the hands of lawmakers. And both the House of Delegates and the State Senate have the ability to make changes to that budget. The House came up with a plan to raise more than $1 billion through online gambling, through a corporate tax return reform, and some other fees and taxes. The Senate didn't want to do quite as much. They just wanted some targeted fees and taxes. There were a few weeks there they went back and forth, and ultimately where it ended is your vehicle registration fees are going to go up. If you have an electric car, you have to pay an extra fee. And if you smoke or use tobacco, you're going to pay more money.
Yeah, Matt Bush, tell me a little bit more about where Marylanders are going to feel a pinch in higher taxes, not broad-based taxes, but higher taxes and fees.
This really is, as Pamela was saying, centers around vehicles and what kind of vehicle you drive. And a lot of that seemed to focus on that this year with the session was a lot on vehicle stuff. You know, the budget in future years is really they're going to have to find new ways to pay for transportation projects going forward. For many reasons. One of them is the gas tax and lower gas tax revenues because people are, thanks to the pandemic, people have been driving less, but also people who drive electric vehicles don't pay the gas tax. So, as Pamela mentioned, there's a fee that goes into just for electric cars for people who aren't paying any gas tax fees. So, you know, going forward, I think we'll see some more things regarding vehicles. But right now with vehicle registrations, there was another bill that goes through that raises vehicle registration fees as well. To help pay for the shock trauma system in the state. That's where I think a lot of the pinch is going to come from, at least in this year, is around vehicle registration.
And you mentioned, Matt, that they're going to be needing to look in future years for ways to fund transportation projects. Also, the blueprint for Maryland's future, the big school reform bill, did they make a down payment on funding that?
A lot of that came last year. I mean, a lot of the funding that, you know, had nothing to do with taxes this year came from other sources or the rebasing that we heard Pamela mention at the top. So going forward, this is really where next year a lot of the questions really begin to come up. And I think Governor Moore, when he put out his budget, said, you know, he didn't want to do any of those kinds of things this year. The Senate stuck to it for the most part. And yesterday, Governor Moore's comments really sort of focused on that there was no broad-based tax increase. There was no sales tax increases, anything like that, in his first 2 years in office. What we will see next year, we'll see next year. We don't know right now, but that'll be, I think, when a lot of these things begin to come up.
And if I could add the tobacco and nicotine taxes, that money is going towards education. It's initially expected to be about $91 million a year, but that's going to go down because when you put nicotine and tobacco taxes up, people use those substances less. So that is a little bit more in that blueprint for Maryland's future kind of pot of funding. It's not enough for the full implementation of the plan, but it does mean there's enough for at least the next 3 school years to implement those programs.
This is On the Record. On WIPR, I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with WIPR's news director, Matt Bush, and Pamela Wood, who covers politics for the Baltimore Banner. We're recapping the 446th session of the Maryland General Assembly, which came to a close yesterday. In response to the collapse of the Key Bridge and the closure of the Baltimore port, lawmakers took up a temporary aid package. Here's Senate President Bill Ferguson speaking earlier this month before the Senate Finance Committee.
While everyone wishes that we had a clear and exact timeline of what the future may hold, unfortunately, that is not something that is available right now. And as a result, the fear in the eyes of individuals who just want to go to work was very present. What we're doing here today with Senate Bill 1188 is trying to provide some modicum of protection and relief for the individuals and the small businesses and the port industries that rely on the everyday full operation of the Port of Baltimore.
Matt, what does the Protecting Opportunities and Regional Trade, or PORT, Act do?
It allows the governor, through using the state's rainy day fund, to set up financial aid for workers and for businesses that are impacted by the suspension of shipping at the Port of Baltimore. That's really the biggest thing it's doing. There's a lot of other parts of this, too, that we're sussing through right now. But those are the biggest things, and that's the importance of this can really be underscored that it was the final bill that the Senate approved last night before adjourning for the year. I think they wanted that symbolism of passing this bill in the final bill of the year. And in less than 2 weeks, it's been 2 weeks today was when the bridge collapsed. So in less than 2 weeks, they were able to get this through. Obviously, there was a lot of urgency on it. It passed unanimously in the Senate to get this through. But, yeah, it sets up financial aid for workers and businesses that are being affected by the closure. It goes into effect immediately once the governor signs it, which he's going to do Tuesday afternoon.
And, Matt, am I right that some of the structure of this legislation is based on lessons learned from the pandemic relief effort?
Absolutely, yeah. I think the pandemic reset so much for all of us, but it did influence how, I think a lot of things, and going forward, it's going to influence how emergency bills are written. There was another one that also passed late last night, too, regarding the collapse of the port, that passed an emergency bill that's going to allow the Attorney General of Maryland to bring lawsuits against people involved with it. This was a bill that was completely rewritten at the behest of the Attorney General so that his office can bring lawsuits related to the collapse, trying to find out more what the Attorney General, whom they may be looking to sue right now, in regards to the incident. But that also passed late last night too. So those two bills in particular are going to have the biggest focus on the collapse of the bridge.
Pamela, you and the Banner's Brenda Wintrode spoke with Governor Moore about the moment he learned that the Key Bridge had collapsed. What did he share with you?
Yeah, the governor at the time the bridge collapsed, which, wow, I can't believe it's two weeks already, he was in Boston. He was up there to speak at an event, receive an award, and he got a phone call from his chief of staff, right after it happened. And he says a lot of what happened in those early hours is a little bit of a blur. And his chief of staff, Bacon Harris, told him the Key Bridge collapsed, and the governor heard it as a Key Bridge collapsed. And he said, which bridge? And Bacon Harris said, the Key Bridge, on the Patapsco River. And much like the rest of us, the governor said he fully grasped the scope of this catastrophe when he saw that video, that live stream video of it just tumbling down into the water. And that's what made it very real for him. And then they scrambled with his staff to get him on a flight back to Baltimore. He was there and he described, riding in the car and turning around the corner and just seeing it gone. And he says that to this day, it still takes his breath away. Realizing that bridge he had seen so many times living in Baltimore, he learned to pilot a boat, drive a recreational boat in that river. And he's still coming to terms with what it means that it's gone.
Still takes his breath away and the rest of us, too. We need to take a short break here on the record. I'm speaking with WIPR's news director, Matt Bush, and with Pamela Wood, who covers the General Assembly for the Baltimore Banner. When we're back, Justice for Juveniles. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. The General Assembly devoted much of the early weeks of the session it wrapped up last night to re-examining juvenile justice reforms it had enacted just 2 years earlier. I'm joined by two journalists who have kept a close eye on Annapolis, WIPR's News Director Matt Bush and Pamela Wood, who covers politics for the Baltimore Banner. House Bill 814 received a final approval in the House on a vote of 114-8. The eight dissenting votes were all from Democrats, including Delegate Kaylin Young, who represents District 45 in Northeast Baltimore. Young said this on the floor of the House last Friday.
Majority party, we have an opportunity that we're not necessarily fully taking. And I say fully taking because I do believe that certainly in the budget and some places in this bill that there are some good things. But we also take some regressive steps that are frankly unnecessary. Unnecessary when we're talking about less than 5 children in 4 years on some of these charges that we're talking about that are 10 to 12. And so as we move forward next year, I really hope that we can think about being more creative.
Pamela, what is Delegate Young labeling regressive steps that are unnecessary?
One of the primary concerns that Delegate Young and others have had is a couple years ago in the reforms, lawmakers basically made it that you couldn't arrest anyone younger than 13. So kids who are, 10, 11, 12 years old, really they not sending off into the court and jail system, instead, diverting them to services. They added back some crimes that those children can now be arrested for, including carrying guns and stealing cars, which everybody knows there's been a big problem with car theft in Maryland. And some lawmakers, that group, including Delegate Young, believe that is regressive and that's not evidence-based, and also that it won't capture that many kids are committing those kinds of crimes. They're very concerned that this is rolling back those reforms.
Matt Bush, why did legislators carry so much concern over juvenile crime into this legislative session?
I think it's inescapable to say a lot of it was media-driven. There's been a lot of coverage of crime in the Baltimore area, even as it's gone down in the city. And juvenile crime statewide has fallen, too. So I think a lot of this was media-driven, and a lot of lawmakers looking at them, they couldn't ignore it. Given the amount of coverage and given the amount of talk there was about this particular issue. So they passed this bill. We'll see how many kids it actually does affect. It may not be that many, but this was something that, did pass with pretty wide numbers, but it was interesting seeing the supporters talk about it. There wasn't this sort of broad-based, just enthusiasm for the bill. It really seemed more of a grim acceptance that this was something that they were going to pass this year, just given how much chatter there was about the issue at the beginning of the session.
Matt, as Pamela mentioned, one of the intents of extended probation periods is to give kids more time to access services. What kind of services?
I will probably defer to her on that question, as they've done a bit more of the coverage on this, but these would be services through the Department of Juvenile Services.
Yeah, that's right. The probation periods now, when a child is put on probation, can be longer. A judge can extend it further and further. And these are services like, anger management, counseling, therapy, family therapy, the kinds of rehabilitative work to help kids, grow and learn and hopefully not reoffend. That said, that is happening under probation. And, some people are concerned about kids still being, wrapped up in the system. But there's a little push and pull because a lot of people want these kids to get this type of counseling and service to help them, but they don't necessarily want them wrapped up in the official juvenile system.
And Pamela, support on a different topic, supporters of medical aid for the terminally ill who want to hasten death were once again disappointed this session. That issue came close to passage 5 years ago. Where did things fall short this year?
Yeah, it was ever so close in 2019. It passed the House of Delegates It went to the state Senate where it failed on a tie vote. You know, you have to have the majority, and it was a tie. It's, you know, been around Annapolis since then, and again, the Senate is where there isn't quite enough support, and Senate President Ferguson and his leadership determined that it wasn't going to have the vote, so he just never brought it. The committees never brought that bill forward. It is a very difficult. It is an emotional one. This is one that support and opposition goes all across party lines. It is not one that either Democratic or Republican leaders press their members to vote one way or another. It's really a conscience vote. And President Ferguson just decided, you know, not to put people through it if it was clear that the votes weren't there this year. So, you know, what's going to change in the next, you know, year three and year four of this term? If people don't change their minds, we may not see it for a vote again.
Matt, lawmakers expanded access to health care for undocumented immigrants. How so?
So those people who are undocumented can now get purchase health care through the state health care exchange. Those were set up, obviously, through the Affordable Care Act, you know, more than a decade or coming up on a decade, I guess, now ago. So now people who are undocumented can get that. They don't get subsidies through it, but they're able to purchase health care through the health care exchange. Supporters arguing that, you know, this extends coverage to people that need it. It's not costing necessarily the state any money. And, you know, it's better to have people insured than not insured. And that these are people who can afford it. So this is now where they'll be able to buy it through the health care exchange.
That's WIPR News Director Matt Bush on the record. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Pamela Wood, who covers politics for the Baltimore Banner. We're recapping key takeaways of this year's legislative session, which ended about less than 10 hours ago. Matt, Maryland is dealing with an estimated shortage of 100,000 homes. Governor Moore introduced legislation he said would give incentives to developers by permitting more dense building in certain areas. What happened to that bill?
Yeah, a lot of these bills did pass. You know, the governor and his team, you know, being very vocal about how many of their bills have passed. I believe all of them was their message of pass. But particularly the housing stuff, a lot of that stuff is getting amended right up until the close and all that. So still have to pour through a lot of those. But the governor and his words yesterday said this is the most aggressive housing package that's ever been put forward in the state, and he talked a lot about it, as did Senate President Ferguson at the beginning of the session, that they had to do some things here to deal with the lack of housing and to deal with basically the cost of housing, and saying that, you know, the real driver of inflation, a lot of focus is on groceries and other things, but feeling that the real driver of inflation is the cost of housing. And this was, to them, wasn't just a housing issue, this was an anti-inflation issue. So a lot of things did pass. We'll go through there, but you know, a lot of them are built to, as you mentioned, to build incentives for people to be able to build affordable housing and things of that nature. A lot of zoning stuff that went through. We'll see what effect it has. Again, a lot of that was being amended. There was some doubt that some of these were even going to pass yesterday. So a lot of those amended. We'll pour through the details now once things have passed to see how much of an impact they're going to have.
Pamela, what about protections for renters?
Yes, so there are two bills that passed. One was from the governor, some more protections for renters. There's also one called the Tenant Safety Act, which is very interesting. If you're a renter and you have a dispute with your landlord, say, repairs that aren't made, there's a process where you can pay your rent, but it goes into sort of a separate escrow account while the dispute is adjudicated. There are some adjustments to that to make it easier for tenants to use. Because, you know, when you're talking about, you know, housing availability and safe and affordable housing, it's not just home buyers and sales. It is also rental units and, you know, trying to make sure that folks can stay in their homes safely in rental housing. So there are two of those renters' rights bills that passed.
Matt, let me shift to another topic. The future of Pimlico Racecourse, home of the Preakness Stakes, has been uncertain for years. 5 years ago, the track closed off nearly 7,000 seats because of safety concerns at the aging facility. What steps did lawmakers take this year to address Pimlico's future?
So one of the final bills that also got passed last night essentially allows the state to take over Pimlico. They'll get it for a dollar from the current owner, and then they will spend up to $400 million doing renovations and other such things at Pimlico, including building a training facility, which should be near around the track. The Preakness will stay through will stay at Pimlico through 2025, through next year. It's going to go to Laurel Park Racetrack in 2026 on this timeline, and then return permanently to Pimlico in 2027, and then Laurel Park will close to racing at that point. And during that year off, when the Preakness isn't there, Pimlico will be renovated by the state. They will operate horse racing out of it. As you said, this is, you know, and it was brought up a lot as the bill was going along, how many different things has the state tried to do to build up Pimlico over the last, really over the last century, this century at least, the last 24 years. This is the latest one. This allows it to take over. Senator President Ferguson, after the bill passed last night, said hopefully we don't have to come back and do anything else about this, that this will be enough. So, yeah, the state will be operating racing at Pimlico. It'll own the course now. It'll be the only one with Laurel Park closing in 3 years, and that's where things will stand. And we'll see if that's enough to keep the Preakness here and to keep horse racing on a steady or stable level in Maryland.
Matt, you pointed out this was a real last-minute set of decisions on the floor last night. The whole bill came up relatively late in this session, right? It seems like a real...
Yeah, it did. It was something that, had been negotiated. The governor's office gave all the reporters details of it before, the bill was introduced. It's been negotiated with the current owners of the two tracks and all that. Really felt that they had to work quickly on this, and there was a sense of urgency with it. And that's where it came through and it passed, and wasn't a whole lot of chatter, at least about the details of the bill once they were all out. I think it was more how often do we have to keep addressing this particular issue, and that was what hurt a lot of how much more does Maryland have to do for this, and we'll see.
Pamela,
If I could add, Sheila, on that, I'm glad you brought it up. I feel like too few people are talking about this. This is a major change in thoroughbred horse racing and a major deal for Baltimore. Part of the delays was for the past year, a state authority has been negotiating with the Stronach Group that owns Laurel and Pimlico on this agreement to donate or for a dollar bring Pimlico to state ownership. And they laid out a roadmap in January, the state authority, but it took a while to fully negotiate all of the details. They didn't want to bring this bill forward to make this happen until they had signatures on paper and a firm commitment from the Stronach Group to actually turn over that track to Maryland. And yes, the bill was introduced in the middle of March, so the last few weeks of session.
Pamela, this was Governor Moore's second legislative session. What did you observe about his involvement this year?
Yeah, the governor, again, as he did last year, did testify on his highest priority bills, those housing bills that we discussed, another bill called the Enough Act, which will send $15 million a year in grants to communities that have high levels of child poverty. That's one of his big goals, is to attack child poverty while he's in office. He did testify. He also invited different groups of lawmakers generally to breakfast at the governor's mansion to talk with them. The last time he had testified was on March 1st, though, and he had been quiet for a few weeks, and then suddenly the Key Bridge collapsed, and he was understandably up in Baltimore spending lots of time. But he started to come back to the state capitol. He was there all day yesterday, making rounds and thanking lawmakers for their work.
Matt, this is probably not a fair question to ask you at the last minute, because a good reporter is probably never surprised, but was there anything that surprised you in this session?
I guess not, really. I always like looking at sort of lower-level bills and other things that passed, and the banner and Pamela's outlet has really been reporting, but we'll try to end on a lighter note, about making persimmon the state fruit. That did not pass, so Maryland will exist for another year without a state fruit. But I don't
think too much
really surprised this year.
Well, thank you.
Somehow we'll have to survive without a state fruit.
Thank you both for walking us through the key takeaways. Matt Bush is WYPR's news director. Pamela Wood covers government and politics for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner. At the On the Record page at WYPR.org, you can find links to coverage of this year's legislative session. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you're with us on the record. Come back tomorrow.